throw off the bow lines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, discover. Mark Twain.
This is episode 276 on the Hidden Why podcast with Frank Gibson.
You're listening to The Hidden Why with your host, Lee.
G'day gang, welcome to The Hidden Why podcast. My name is Lee Munnelty, The Hidden Why Guy, here to assist you and inspire you to live life with greater passion and purpose. To do that, first, you must discover your why. And once you define your life compass, you can make better decisions, take more purposeful action towards living a life with greater freedom, fulfillment, and happiness. That's what it's all about here at The Hidden Why. And to do that, I interview some inspiring guests, people that we can learn from every week. And today's guest, certainly there's some insights to be had. His name is Dr. Frank Gibson. Dr. Frank Gibson. He has a Bachelor of Science and Business Administration, and he has studied science both East and West, and he finds the Eastern practice of medicine quite powerful and profound. He's also an entrepreneur. He's been driven towards, you know, financial success and creating that financial freedom, so a lot of insights in that as well. But he's also a believer in following his curiosities, his passions, and his interests, and I think that's something to be admired as well, people who really do follow their heart and do what they desire. That's what I certainly want to do myself. So he's got an interesting story and a lot of insights and lessons to be had in this. You can check out my key takeaways at thehiddenwhy.com. Now, he has a product called Sobrexa that he's created. Now, it's to assist people to get control and moderation of their drinking. So it's an interesting concept, an interesting product. Now, I don't know the science behind it. The science behind it is, it sounds fascinating, and how he came up with that idea he shares within this episode. So it is certainly interesting, but sometimes things like this sound too good to be true. So what are your thoughts? I'll let you be the judge whether it's true or not. Perhaps you've had some experience using it. I certainly haven't, so I can't really comment. But for what it is, he's, you know, attempting to help others, and I think there's always power in that sort of value. So let me know what you think. Jump onto thehiddenwhy.com, leave your comments and thoughts there as well. And make sure you subscribe to The Hidden Why podcast. Subscribe to The Hidden Why newsletter online at thehiddenwhy.com. And guys, I have THY TV. It is out. It is alive. So it's breathing. I'm going to give it a go for 6 months and see how it progresses. It's an extension of The Hidden Why, so more inspiration to guide people to living their life as they truly desire. So check that out, THY TV YouTube channel. You can just type in Lee Munnelty, THY TV, and I'm sure it will come up there. Subscribe to that if you do love it. And guys, as always, if you love the show, if you love what you're hearing, share it with your network for me. Make sure you use the Amazon links in the show notes to do all your Amazon shoppings, but to pick up the books as well. It helps support the show. And if you haven't yet done it, could you leave me a review at iTunes? Just a 5-star review, 1 to 5 stars, depending on where you rate us, and a little brief comment. That'd be awesome. Guys, enjoy this show with Frank Gibson.
This is The Hidden Why, discussing ideas and thoughts on living life with passion and finding your hidden why, your reason, your purpose.
G'day ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Hidden Why podcast. My name's Lee Martinuzzi. I've got Frank Gibson here with me today. How are you, Frank?
I'm doing great. I'm very happy to be here.
Mate, it's a pleasure to have you here. Looking forward to chatting to you. Got lots of questions around addiction, alcohol addiction in specific, and a bunch of other questions I want to ask you about your journey as well. What, first of all, Frank, the big questions, what did you have for lunch today?
I actually had a fish sandwich, an unusual fish. It was called a yellowhead grouper. Never had had it, and it was delicious.
A yellowhead grouper. Okay. Nice. Sounds healthy. And what part of the world are you in, Frank? You're in Florida?
I am in Key Largo, Florida, which is the first of the island keys, and I love it. Nicest water, protected water, beautiful ocean, living reefs, really nice.
Okay, and what attracts you to that part of the world?
I just love the ocean. I spend the summers, I have a home in the mountains in North Carolina, and it's nice and cool, and about this time of year, I start missing the ocean and my sailboat, so I left about a week ago and headed down to Key Largo, and I'll be here probably until the end of April.
Okay. Yeah, cool. And mate, it sounds like you've got the life, and it sounds like you've got quite a meaningful life, just an external perspective from what I've read about you. What's the journey? You've had a fascinating journey. You've done a lot of different things. I know you've studied in business administration, and then you've done some, was it study in Singapore as well? Is that correct?
It's true. I guess my careers don't make sense to people. I have my first degree in music, and I was a musician, and then I went into business, and then I was, you know, got lucky and got in and out of that business in about 10 years and decided I wanted to do something more useful with my life. And at that point, I explored going into medicine and standard Western medicine, and I was accepted at St. James University in the islands in St. Vincent, Grenada. It was, you know, those are easier, you know, MCAT, kind of accelerated study, and you're on a Caribbean island. It couldn't get any better, except partway into it, I realized I really wasn't in love with being a Western MD. It wasn't how I felt I wanted to work with people. So I did. I went to Singapore, and I studied traditional Chinese medicine, mostly focusing on herbs, and that's part of the story that leads how I ended up with Sobrexa, because it's from medicinal plants, but with a very high-tech method of extracting phytochemicals from the plants. And it's just been a lot of fun, and we've helped tens of thousands of people.
So sorry, what was that? I missed that part. You've got a plant that you've introduced or grow?
Yeah, I always had an interest in medicinal plants. I've been a kind of a wilderness adventurer and started out kind of figure out what I could eat in the woods and things. I studied with a Chinese Kung Fu and herb master when I was real young for a long time. And I just loved the medicinal plants. And I had seen amazing healing from things he did with plants, including the restoration of my knee, which had a torn meniscus and no cartilage, and a condition that they told me could only be helped with surgery. So the master put me on an herb regimen, and it was remarkable. I mean, totally never had a day of problems, and I was in my early 20s. So the herbs, that was always in my mind. So after I decided Western medicine wasn't what I wanted to do, I decided if I really wanted to study, put years into studying traditional Chinese medicine, herbology, and combined with the Western biochemistry and this incredible medicinal plant knowledge that exists in Asia for 5,000 years, it gave me a foundation to create Sobrexa. And Sobrexa grew from clinics that I opened that were integrative. And if people needed Western medicine, you know, we got it for them, but then they went on herb programs, they had exercises, we had classes, we had diets, and we really tried to get involved with them and just give them an opportunity to have some basis of truth and trust in their bodies, which is exactly what I do with Sobrexa in the Last Call program. It's amazing because it is really giving the body the opportunity to fix itself.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. I just want to I'm fascinated by your career and your path, and I really appreciate people that, you know, go and do something and then have that change and do something else and then continue that change, you know, and not be afraid to do so. Was there anything in particular that came about from these changes, or any particular reason why you made these changes? Was it just because you weren't happy? What was it?
No, I don't know. I guess you could say I get bored easily. I just kind of go after things, and I feel like things just sort of come up to me. My first career was, I'll just be honest about it, it was an opportunity to just go make some money, really, you know, or make nothing at all, make a lot of money. And it was, you know, I left the music business, which was my love since I was a little kid, and I got in the music business, and I loved the music, but not the business of music. So I went back to school and earned a business degree. I chose going into the restaurant industry because I love food. I grew up in a home where meals were a big part of life, and I was fascinated with the business of fine dining. And at the time, America was in a big shift from food at home to much more dining out. So yeah. I met a guy with a lot of money, and he'd founded Burger King, and he sold it, and he had the money, and I had he probably had all the brains, or most of them, and I just knew how to work hard. We built 9 luxury-oriented steakhouses and sold them. And so that's what you do when you're that age, if you can. And You know, that was my immediate goal, make a lot of money to create a financial foundation as quickly as possible so that I would never be limited and I would be able to do whatever I chose the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I was good at it. And then it changed. And I think as we reach different stages of our lives, Lee, things, the stages change our needs. They change how we feel about doing things. You know, in my 20s, that was the time. Just go out there and do it. And, you know, it was inspiring that I knew it was not going to be my lifelong career. It was a means to the end. And so we did that, and it stuck to the plan. And then what next? That was the part that I think you're hinting about a little bit, is how do people do that? How do they, okay, you got this great thing you want to do. And, you know, what I did was I took 3 years off. It wasn't about finding myself, but it was a very critical time to understand how I could develop a career that, and I wasn't sure what it was going to be, but I knew, I mean, I'm a passionate person. I have strong compassion. I don't know if it's a desire or more a need to do something useful for others. But my position put me in a place where I had some independence and I could make that choice. And that's why I decided, you know, medicine was the first thing that came up. And then that evolved because I didn't want to do it. And that's what I sense from your message and some of the things that I'm kind of feel like you do with people is you bring them to the point. You're creating a foundation for people, I think, and others like you that do this, because they don't have a starting place, Lee, most of the ones that I meet. They don't have a starting place. You know, they want to make a change, but they don't know how to go about it. And it can be scary. And I think maybe that's even the first step. I don't know. I mean, is that your experience? Their first step to me is like, they're just stuck. They're fearful.
Yeah. Well, it's the ultimate thing of making that change. And I think a lot of us feel like we're alone and that's why it becomes so scary. You know, making that change, we've been conditioned so heavily in one way that we think, you know, the world will come crashing in if we try something different. And being that we don't have that support around us, which is where I guess the hidden why might come into play, to help encourage people and give people that support, that feeling of security, so they can go out there and do that. But yeah,
that's exactly what I'm trying to express is that they go somewhere, and it's like if all you ever do is get them to realize, hey, I can do this. See, and that's what it comes down to, is that how big is their passion? I mean, it's just to no question. I mean, to me, if I ever have to question something, then it's. I mean, I have music. I'm still very, very active music. I know a lot of people, and I stay active in it, and I love what I can love about it. I don't like the business of it, and I don't care if I make money doing it. But the point is that when it comes down to people going, you know, go back to the statistic that I came across recently. 70% of people in America are dissatisfied. Only 1% say they love their work. This is part of your message. Why, you know, why can't people find a career that uses their talents and abilities that they can go out and say, this is what I really love. I'm going to go do it. And somehow we have to help them go over the hump or help them stay right where they are, because, you know, they're not, it's not, it's just an idea. They're not really, it's not, right, they're not really. Yeah. I love sailboats, and I know a guy who's got 40,000 miles sailing all over the world, and guy in his marina says, he came back from a long trip, guy in the marina says, hey, you know, and I understand you've been around the world. I'm going to do that someday. And this guy's, you know, he's kind of straightforward. He said, no, you're not. You got the money. You got the boat. You've been talking about it for 5 years. You're not going to do it. You just want to talk about it.
Well, yeah. And there's plenty of that out there, which is fine. You know?
It is. That's my point. It's not that people should do it, but if they're ready to make the leap, they need someone that understands it. They need someone that can, even if you're just saying to them, hey, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens if we don't make it? If we end up with no money, if we go after our hearts, desire, if we go for something for love, we will end up with maybe no money, but we'll have more self-respect, integrity, and dignity than we ever imagined. And money can't buy that.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. And that's exactly what I just had this conversation with a mate, last week or something, and just talking about that path, you know, the path that I could have taken when I decided to go full forward towards the hidden why and creating this, or staying on that track that I was on, which was in corporate executive management. And certainly, you know, one path I was a bit more certain with, a bit more comfort around it. But I sort of had a lot of uncertainty around it too. I didn't know where it could take me. It could have taken me to, you know, a place which ended up without money, or, you know, with all that risk of fear of loss that we have. Whereas the other path I knew would have been more fulfilling because it was more aligned with what I really wanted to do. And it still had the same level of risk and uncertainty, you know, as the other path. Yes. But at least I knew in the process of living my life, I would have enjoyed it more. So that's what made me do the change.
Well, and you make a good example for people. And I think that, you know, if people, when you do something like this, so a friend of mine told me a term I hadn't heard. Is, he said, you know, you always seem to have a lifestyle business, meaning I always seem to have a lifestyle business. And I asked him what he meant by that. And he says, it means you're not just strictly focusing on a monetary reward.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because you're serving your passion. And, you know, unfortunately, just because it's a passion doesn't mean it's not going to fail. So, yes, there is fear there. But anything we do that we enter into, we consider – there's going to be some sort of fear, and it's just the steps. And what you can do helping coach people, I'm sure, is help them identify what they need to get there and help them maybe formulate the process and the steps, laying the groundwork. One of the things I've done a lot in my life is wilderness adventures, solar adventures into deep wilderness, mountain climbing. And, you know, I love the part before the trip when you're preparing everything and you're cutting your toothbrush in half so you're getting your weight down. And, I mean, every little tiny thing you do, you're ready to go. But I think what I see in what people like you do, it's like you're telling people how to pack.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready to do this? It's scary. I mean, you're not going to tell them it's not scary. I'm not going to tell them it's scary.
Yeah.
But being prepared takes away the fear.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good analogy with the, you know, packing for the hike.
Yes, exactly.
What I love too is that you seem to, I mean, just in your story, you seem to have always done things that you're interested in, but like you've done the music, you're interested in food, you had curiosity around that, so you did that. Even though there was a greater drive of earning that money, you know, there was still the element of love and passion behind it, which I think helps with you know, that drive, the self-motivation to get up and keep going despite what obstacles you might be facing. And no matter what you do, you're always going to face those obstacles, but if you have that love behind it, that just keeps you pushing forward. Is there anything else there that sort of you can resonate with or share with the audience that sort of kept you there? Or, yeah.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the connections we make in terms of, you know, people we are. I'm a firm believer that anybody with a passion attracts people. And I've had a great opportunity for inspiration with people I've been around. When I did this restaurant thing, I was a kid, and Dave Edgerton had, you know, was in his mid 40s, and he'd been successful, sold his company for $12 million in the 60s. That's a lot of money back then. But he was so exciting. He had such great vision and just an inspiring man. And he took a chance on a kid, and, you know, it worked out. And we're still friends 47 years later. And it was, I think that I go back in my life and I think of people, and they may have just done one thing. I can remember a guy, probably one of the first jobs I ever had when I got out of school before I joined Dave. It was a fast growing company and seafood company restaurants. And I thought, wow, this is great. And they stick me in a store as an assistant manager, and the place is just a wreck and it's dirty. And first night I'm there, I stay up in the back door in the garbage area. I mean, I pressure washing and clean and practically scrubbing with acid. I'm getting the thing spotless. I'm so proud of it. The back step, you know, restaurants, like people walk in and out, that concrete's black. I scrubbed it up. I'm up until like 4 o'clock. I go home and get a little sleep, come back and, you know, know, I can't wait for the, you know, general manager of the company to come check, you know, check on the thing. And he walks in the door, walks right through, and he says, that fire extinguisher is filthy. And he just keeps on going. My first response was like, you son of a gun. But then I realized, you know, yeah, there's a chrome fire extinguisher. It's all filthy. And I just didn't finish the job. And I can't tell you, it's a joke to people who've worked with me. And is, you know, they'll see me sometimes like in the lab and I'll look in there. Of course, everything is, there's a control manager. Everything has to be completely perfect. But, you know, we have kind of, the fire extinguisher. It means no matter whatever job that I've ever done, I got to make sure that the last thing I did was shine that fire extinguisher, clean it up. So I think we get a lot from people that we run into, and whether we use it or not, it's up to us.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you could have taken the wrong message from that.
Yeah.
And not had that learning, or you could have taken the right message. And for me, that is, you know, what you're saying is when you do your work, and I just had another conversation with another gentleman this morning, and it was about, you know, just doing your best potential when you're doing it, and then showing up as best you can, and not just becoming sloppy or lazy just because, you know, you don't feel like it. And that'll take you a much further distance in life.
Well, no, the rest of the story, Lee, is crazy, because when Dave Edgerton decided he was going to start these luxury-owned restaurants, he was looking for someone to come in and run the first one, and he went to this man. Carlone's his name, and the one that told me the fire extinguisher, I missed the fire extinguisher. And John had, by that time, had his own chain of restaurants going, and he said, no, but I'll tell you the guy to call. He's young, but call him.
Ha, there you go.
Yep. So, you know.
And that's one of the lessons that I, you know, when I first started in personal development, when I just was sort of, I don't know what happened, but anyway, now, long story, I wasn't showing up. My attitude wasn't right, and I had this sour taste about everything, and my first mentor, his message was, you know, just show up, just show your attitude, you know, always give your best, you know, and despite what happens. And it's so easy sometimes to fall into the trap of, you know what, I just don't feel like it, or, you know what, they're not pulling their weight, so I'm not going to pull my weight, or, you know what, she's just not being friendly to me, so I'm not going to, you know, help her out. And we can have that sort of an attitude, but it doesn't help us in our process, in our path in life. At all. So it's better just to keep being as real as you can, as honest as you can to yourself, as integral as you can, and really, always putting your best foot forward.
Well, Ian, I think that my experience is that draws that out of people. They kind of come into your energy of doing that. And that's, I don't know, I think it's just a perfect way for people to start to connect, because it's positive.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't always happen, does it? But it is very infectious.
And I'm old enough to know that a lot of times things you expect aren't going to happen. But it doesn't mean I change my life or become cynical or anything else. You know, it's unfortunate people miss some of these kind of things. But when you work with people, I think what you must do to a degree is help them understand they're not limited, and being patient with them. Which, you know, that you find do limit themselves, and then that's going to open that energy up for them. And that's probably as big as, you know, you telling them, you know, something specific, go do this, as this general idea of how we relate in business and life.
Yeah. You sound like a very ambitious dude, and I can see that in your energy. What are the barriers, but to, you know, your beliefs of what is possible? Because a lot of young people, I guess, you know, would love to, you know, open a restaurant. I love food myself. So I mentioned it to my wife the other week. I said, I should open a restaurant here in Japan. It didn't go down too well because I've got too many things on my plate already. But what is it that keeps you pushing through those barriers, those obstacles? What's helped you?
I think what's helped me is to take the steps to prepare for there's things that I believe that we can do before we get to the stage where we're deciding we do it. The things that give it, that take it from just this kind of wish floating around in our brains to where it's something that's okay, I'm going to do this, and these are steps. Just like you said, the packing is a good example. Or you're going to go do a show. So, you know, I think that people have to make sort of notes to themselves, and And you've got a great story, and I've got a great story, and but those people can't know our story. They can know about our story, but how do they know our hearts? What drove us? How do we make that jump? Heck, we hardly know it ourselves. Ooh. So I try to help people understand, look, you've got to find your own story. You've got to go into yourself, and there's some steps you can do. First thing is people need to identify what it is they're after. How are they going to go after something if they haven't identified it? And then all they knew after that is to determine what they need to get there. Forget the want part. At that point, it's only, what do I need? Because if you're really going to go out and do it, I don't care if it's a restaurant or doing what I did or, you know, totally change careers or go back to school. Once you make that, then you have to go after it. Mm. You've got to be totally successful in your mind, and that means you have to be totally selfish. You're everyone around you. I know it's hard on families. I know it's hard on associates and friends, but they will benefit from being around someone with that kind of power and that kind of experience and ability to commit. And the results don't matter, but usually, you know, even if you fail, the results are, wow, what a guy.
Yeah, and that's the truth, isn't it? And you touched on, you know, a couple of things there. Firstly, you know, identifying what are you after, and I guess that comes to connections with your values. Certainly we've talked about passion and I guess in a sense dreams as well. Like, you know, what do you dream about? But you touched on needs there, you know, and what do you need? And I think we're driven a lot of sense, and certainly I was, by needs that aren't really needs at all. They're just created needs, things that we think we need. And they can drive us in the wrong direction.
Well, see, that's very astute. I like that. They can drive us in the wrong direction. They're not just a distraction. I mean, that goes away. They actually can alter, you know, the whole plan.
Yeah. Like if you have a need, like, you know, I used to think about having a really flash car, and it seemed like I was just trying to force life to happen for that need that I didn't actually need. And if I look at my life now, I don't really need much, man. Like I've got most of it covered. And that gives me a greater sense of doing what I do and just enjoying the process, you know, rather than stressing about having these things that just don't mean anything and won't matter at the end of the life anyway. Certainly that's been something that resonates with me, but what's your experience with that?
Well, I mean, what I sense about you, and we're halfway across the world, I'm assuming, but, you know, is that you don't measure your life by your belongings. On the last day of your life, you're not going to be out there, you know, polishing your car, or, you know, that's not what it's about. Is sometimes when I'm working with people and they have a lot of stress, or they're trying to conquer this, you know, their alcohol use disorder, I say, look, you know, on the last day of your life, you're not going to be thinking about this because you're going to have a power because you fixed this. And if something's bothering us, how many times 2 weeks later, oh, that wasn't such a big deal. Mm. And I think that's what's important. You know, if you end up with, you know, with your favorite, you know, Ferrari or whatever, fine. But that's, I don't know many successful people where that's been the goal.
Yeah.
I wanted to make money as a kid, and because I wanted to have choices. I saw so many people that thought they were limited because they didn't have the money.
Yeah, certainly, you know, and that's a lot of people relate with that. You know, that money piece. It's just always, it seems to be a big battle out there. But is it a big battle because of the extension of what we think we need?
Yeah, I think that to write off a dream and a passion because you don't have the money, I mean, there's always a way.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be fearless. I mean, quite honestly, you know this, you went through it. You have to be open and fearless, but you have to be open and fearless to any possibility. Hmm. You know, when I started doing this, it was in a clinical setting. It was $7,500, and people still were in a clinic. They were reluctant. There were barriers. You know, in the U.S., it's the social stigma. It's the number one reason. The cost is a reason. And, you know, I looked at it, and then I said, you know, I'm going to sell these clinics. I'm going to just focus on this because it was working so amazingly, 84% success rate. And so my son, who's, you know, I'm a lot more tech-oriented than I was at the time. I've kind of caught up with some things in the modern world. But he goes, we need to sell to people. Drop the price. Take away all the barriers. I said, how are we going to sell? He said, we'll put it on the internet. I was like, okay, we'll drop it from $7,500 to $799. Who's going to go on the internet? This was in 20, 11 and buy an $800 product from somebody they never heard of. And he said, you'd be surprised. And Lee, it was crazy. We did over, we had over 3,000 clients the first year. And that shows you how desperate it is. And we beat all the barriers. We literally, the cost wasn't an issue anymore. The, you know, it's at home. It comes in a plain brown box. Nobody knows about it. And it, you know, we just took away the obstacles and helped people. And our first marketer was more transaction oriented, and we wrestled with that, and we built our own marketing company, and then we teamed up with a marketing partner about a year ago, and we understand it's all about education. It's education and helping people trust us and know that what we want is for them to get better. You know, people go around, they often say, the more you give, the more you get.
Yeah.
I can tell you, in my experience, it's the happiest thing that I think I have in my life, is that the more I give, and I answer every email, I talk to clients whenever they want to, I keep up with it. But it's true. We're just doing our best to help people understand. My message for anybody isn't go buy my product. It's simply one of hope based on the new science of addiction, and that it's possible to restore health and a happy life. I get with someone on the phone, or they, you know, my marketing company puts me in a studio and just turns the camera on, and, you know, they have me up on my farm last month, and horses coming over, and they just say, go say something about this. I'm really good at helping people in need understand the root of their problem. And when they understand that, hey, there really is, now science knows why I have an addiction. When I see that glimmer of hope in their eyes, that realization that they really can change their life, it's done. They're going to be successful. Then we do everything possible to help them keep their commitment and attain success, including taking them through the program another time with someone holding their hand through the whole thing. I mean, this is a global, worldwide problem. Yeah. I'm passionate as heck, as you've already picked up, about bringing this message to 17 million Americans who suffer from alcohol use disorder, especially the 15 million who never seek treatment. No one in this country is going into treatment. They've given up on the old treatment options. We're still doing, and so is your country, doing the same thing we were doing in 1950. Only 1.2% of those people in America that need treatment believe it works.
Yeah.
We have to, I just encourage everybody I can to find out about this new science, to help everyone they know, because everybody knows someone who has this problem, that there have been huge advances in the science of addiction.
So talk about this new science of addiction, yeah.
So if we're not selling anything here today, and if people find something else that works for them, great. But 80% of people go into an abstinence program, fail.
Yeah. Why is that?
And that can be changed. The reason is because it's not about control. People, when someone's around and someone who's drinking excessively, if it's a family member or friend, like, why don't you just don't drink so much? What we know in science today, Lee, is clearly that it's a physiological problem and why it's occurring and how we can reverse it.
Okay.
But the treatment programs, centers, there's 14,000 of them in America, they're based on occupancy rates.
Yeah, right.
They're not utilizing the new science. Now people can do it in their home. And so it's I can't tell you this. I've never done anything this cool in my life.
Yeah. So I guess can you share some insight as to, you know, why, or this new science, around this new science, and why we drink too much?
Yeah, I can. And it's really simple, because it comes down to two brain chemicals that everyone, I guess somewhere maybe came across it in school, but they forgot about it. And so you have these two chemicals. One is glutamate, and it's like the accelerator on your gas pedal. And the other one is called GABA, GABA. It's gamma-amide butyric acid. And it's sort of the brakes. And they're always in balance.
Yeah.
And then, but some people, maybe they're born with a little bit of an imbalance, or the consistent use of excessive alcohol over a long period of time starts to change the imbalance.
So what balance? What is the balance change?
These two chemicals in the brain.
Which goes higher?
So let's say one of them is the accelerator and one of them is the brake pedal. Yeah. So drinking excessively, picture two, this is what I do in my book to help people understand. Picture two bowls of marbles.
Yeah.
And they got exactly, they're exactly the same. And you got a lot of nights and you're drinking excessively 2-3 times a week. And you're getting a few extra marbles over in this bowl of the accelerator, the glutamate. You know, this is the one that drives you to drink. Well, you're getting a few more. But when you're using alcohol, your body, it masks those. The body doesn't know it's getting these extra, actually, neurotransmitters, but it doesn't know that it's these extra marbles. And so it just keeps building them up. And then one day you're like, man, I got to get control of my life. I need to cut back on alcohol. So you quit. Hmm. And then your body starts to realize they're there, because now there's like all these massive, more and way more than it needs. And they're all, you know, clamoring for alcohol. And it's, if you don't get alcohol, you're going to have tremens. You're going to have all the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal, and it, even exotoxic death in a severe case. So what your brain is supposed to do is tell you how you fix that. It tells you get some alcohol.
Right.
I've never met anyone that drank excessively, got a DUI, made a fool of themselves at a party. I never met anybody that went there, left the house intending to do that. They can't help it. They go out to have 3 beers and they drink 3 six-packs because these extra neurotransmitters fire up, these extra marbles fire up on the accelerator pedal and off they go. They're off to the races. They don't have a chance. It's the only disease that you get in trouble for. If people are like, why are you drinking so much? It's a disease. Everyone in science knows it's a brain chemical disease.
Mm.
And I have a free guide on our website, and I'll give you the information at the end if it's okay, where people can go. They can get this free guide. If what I just explained, they can do it. They know someone with a drinking problem. Hey, take it to them. They can get, you know, they can download my book. They can get it from Amazon. But the point is, it's not about selling my product. It's about how they can do this, why they can do it. Yeah, no one can start doing anything. These people that suffer from alcohol use disorders, they just lost hope, and so have their families. And what could be better for a job than, you know, you change one person's life that's drinking excessively, you change 15, 20 people around them.
The whole of their circle. That's interesting stuff. Now, you talk about, what is it, glutamate? Is that how you pronounce it?
Glutamate, yes.
Glutamate. And, yes. You know, the accelerator. And if we increase that by drinking, but we're also numbing the effects of the increased glutamate, is that correct? Have I got that right?
Yeah, the body doesn't know it's there as long as you keep this alcohol in your body. It only knows it's there, that you have this excessive one when you pull the alcohol away.
And
that's why people have to go into detox, because they have to quickly, they give them barbiturates and benzodiazepines to get them through this stage of the withdrawals, which, I mean, literally people die from it. But mostly they have severe tremens and they have hallucinogenic experiences, and they, you know, they have a lot of problems. And, you know, a good parallel, Lee, is to think about people with blood sugar problem.
Yeah.
These are the very similar symptoms. Someone has their blood sugars low, they start to shake, they start to have mental confusion, they sometimes hallucinate, and, you know, they're like, give me some orange juice. You have any orange juice? And people run to the refrigerator and get them some orange juice, and they drink it, and they go, oh, that kind of breaks down. Well, no one's hiding the orange juice. They say, no, you can't have any orange juice. It's, what's the difference? These people need this. Your body actually needs alcohol when you just cut it off, and that's why. And then you go in the hospital and you detox for 3 days. You know, in all these years, in 23 years, we've never had a client need an inpatient detox. We don't even tell them to stop drinking. We don't want them to stop drinking, because if they shut it off too quickly, they're going to have a problem. And what's really cool, Lee, is that, because, you know, I don't see the people individually, but I did in the clinics. I saw thousands of people when we had it in clinic setting. At one point, we had 14 clinics that were using our protocol, and we just shut it all down and cut the price to nothing practically. But when I would sit with these people, it was just phenomenal. Watching them, and they'd say to their wives or husbands, what do you mean? You didn't tell them to quit drinking. I said, no, I didn't. Well, he's drinking a half a quart a day. Well, okay. second, third week, the wife comes in. She says, God, John's leaving. You know, he pours a drink and he sits there. The ice melts. He cracks a beer. You know, he doesn't finish his third beer. And I said, good. See, then the clients and the family starts to understand, hey, my body's changing. You can't control this. You know, people that I'm sure in your life that have abstained, and they go to, you know, self-help groups, and they, you know, the rest of their life, they're on edge. Their family is waiting for them to relapse any minute. And I wouldn't want to go through life wondering. I think I'd rather just be raising Cain and drinking than to one.
Yeah. And I guess with
this sword hanging over my head.
Yeah. And it's, you said it in the pre-interview there, you said, you know, it's been a part of our culture for eons, you know, to have a drink, and you know, there, a lot of people do enjoy it. So why not do something that you enjoy? But when you do it or abuse it, that's when it becomes, you know, a bit of a problem in our society. But so you sort of think that it's okay to keep that culture alive and have those few drinks.
Well, it's just, anytime you force something on people, or you force people to make a commitment that they're 80%, that we know that 80% against them, that they're going to keep the commitment, you're not helping them. And and it is a big part. And like you, I've spent a lot of time in other countries, in Asia, and a lot of time in Europe, and more so than America. You know, these, you know, people, drinking is a part of life. You have kids at the family, you know, at the table doing homework with the 2-hour dinner sometimes, you know, it's just such a part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And what is someone supposed to do? They got abstained, so they're not supposed to go in a bar. Hey, just go get a whole new set of friends. Don't be around people who are drinking. Don't go to this party. What? How are you going to do that? I drink. I don't have a desire not to drink. And let's say you're trying to control it, and you're going to say, well, I'm going to moderate my drinking. I know I got a problem. So when I go out, I'm going to make sure I only have that one glass of wine the waiter pours. And then you're talking to the guy on your left, and the waiter dumps some more wine in your glass, and you're drinking it. And pretty soon you get enough in you, those neurotransmitters fire up, and you're off to the races. You're hitting the accelerator again.
Okay.
What happens with our program when your body's in balance is that we help people understand, just pay attention, have certain markers. You know, you want to have some beers, fine. You know, open three beers, fine. You start opening the fourth, then you want the fifth. Just go back and take Sobrexa for a week. Your body will go right back into balance. When you're out in the dinner and the waiter's filling your wine glass, you're probably going to leave the table with wine in the glass because your body doesn't want it. Mm. That's how it works for, I don't know the statistics in other countries, but in America, 82% of people who enjoy alcohol do it as a normal, healthy part of a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Sobrexa. That's the natural plant. That's a Chinese herb, is it?
Sobrexa is it's a combination. It's an interesting story. I had a chance to live with a Chinese family who've been doctors for 39 generations. And it was an amazing experience. And, of course, you know, the Chinese, you paid your doctor to keep you well. And if you got sick, if you ended up with hypertension, you didn't pay him until he fixed it again. And so the point was that they kept all their formulations and everything secrets because it was competitive.
Hmm.
And so they opened up their, you know, basically everything to me. And I was translating, reading these, some of them were written on pieces of paper, probably 75 years old. And they'd had them for generation after generation. This one said, talked about, alcohol. And I said, is this for alcohol? And it was seven herbs. And he said, yeah, you drink too much. You take it. You don't drink too much. I said, does it work? He said, well, I don't think we would have passed it down for 9 generations or whatever he said, you know, if it didn't work. So I said, can I have it? And he said, yeah, you do some good with it. And so I took a different approach, Lee, than what anybody else is doing in the industry that we call the herb dietary supplement industry. I thought, okay, if we do this, we have to have a way to control it. We have to know. So what are plants made of? They're made of phytochemicals.
Hmm.
And it's the phytochemicals. You can say, oh, this plant, you know, Radix pyrii is responsible for you don't want to drink so much. But what is the phytochemical? What are the plant chemicals? So that's how I approach this. I took these 7 plants and I analyzed what they contain, isoflavones and terpenes and all the parts of plants chemically. And I found out, I discovered in 6 years of study to figure out what actually is making this plant work. It's not the plant, it's the phytochemicals. Some of them, instead of taking the phytochemical that I wanted from a single plant, I found other plants that had it. And because I wanted the biodiversity and be able to make sure the action was long lasting. So I worked with this for a very, very long time. And I ended up expanding it to 14 plants. But most importantly, and my son was a big part of this, we determined how we could bring these chemicals out of the plants. At the end, we throw the cellular matter away, and we bring these chemicals out of the plants in a controllable way, in a way that it's quantified, so the, you know, 100,000th bottle is exactly the same as the first bottle, and that's not something that the herb business typically does. And we built our own lab, and we developed this process, and it took years. From the time we told the sold the clinics to where we had this product, but I mean it's remarkable, and I put my life into it, and I'll tell you, Lee, I'm still astounded sometimes. I have people email me in the second week going, I can't believe it, I hardly want to drink, and I have to, I have to kind of hold back from saying that even to people, because, you know, the next person, it could take, and they could be in the sixth week, they could go 8 weeks and they're still, you know, craving some alcohol. And we say, okay, you know, let's just do it again. We send them a free program, and, you know, our medical director and I get involved sometimes, and, you know, Carol, who's been with us 23 years, and Catherine, and they'll get on the phone and talk to these people, and just open the door to them, because that's what people aren't used to. They're used to being sold. They're not used to being helped. And I'll tell you, it's taken us a long time to get where we, you know, where people understand that that's because I've gotten sometimes where I'm leery of people who are like saying, trust me.
Yeah, and I get that. And I guess that's where, you know, and I worry about time here, Frank, because we're having a great chat, but I warned you this might happen. You know, a lot of us do get these, you know, too good to be true sort of things thrown at us. And because it's so rampant out there, we, you know, we often now just bring up those questions and go, it sounds great, but, you know, is it real? Because, you know, I've tried this before, I've tried that before, and it ended up just being something that didn't actually work for me. And you know, in my opinion, Frank, that every one of us is so different. So I always question, is one way actually going to work for another person? Because I myself have tried many different things to battle, you know, certain problems that I've faced in life, and some things have worked and some things haven't worked. Whereas I know other people that have used it and had success where it didn't have success for me. So I guess that's where the skepticism comes about. Can I ask, is this Sobrexa, is that the sort of, I guess, the tonic or whatever you call it, to bring back the balance between that glutamate and GABA?
Yes. Sobrexa creates an opportunity for the body to change so it no longer craves excessive alcohol. Okay. It doesn't do anything to the body. It creates the opportunity, and it rebalances the physiological effect.
So you notice in your patients that, you know, even if they're heavy drinkers typically every day, whatever it might be, that by taking this, it helps them, I guess, reduce that craving that they get across.
Most of the people, by the end of 8 weeks, they take it three times a day. It's only 2 ounces a week. They take 4 ounces their first week, and then 2 ounces at small dose. They take it three times a day. If they can take, they can take more if they want. We give them extra four bottles in case they spill it or, you know, they need more. But the point is that for most people around the fifth, sixth week, they really notice a change in their alcohol, and they did it themselves. It isn't like, you know, you don't get sick if you take it. You don't have to run out and try to stop. Surely we ask them to cut back and not be stupid about it. But for the majority of the people,
it becomes a more of a natural.
And by at the end of 8 weeks, they're fine. And some of them will call us and they say, I'm not sure. I say, well, fine, use your extra bottles and take it for another 2 weeks. Who cares? Our measurement of the 84% is at the end of 1 year. They're still not drinking excessively. And about 20, it's changing. It's less and less. It used to be about 30% just didn't drink at all. It's changing because, I don't know, in this country, the National Institute of Health's organization, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, has changed from an abstinence program to where they're saying now it's okay to have, and healthy for an American, to have 14 drinks a week. As long as they don't have them all on the same night, you know. I mean,
That's what I'd do. I'd have them all on the same night and not drink for the rest of the week.
Well, but with our program, Lee, you wouldn't. You'd lose interest. I had a guy once come. You know, we have a big retreat center, and we used to, when we had the 14 clinics, they would come to the retreat center for what we called pre-treatment experience. It was a lifestyle program for five days. Well, this guy went to the town nearest Asheville, is known as the beer capital of the United States. I mean, everybody's there. It's probably 100 breweries. It's a little tiny city. And he came to go party and really blow it out. And when he showed up for the program, he was complaining. He said, man, I wanted to come up here and drink. Well, we had sent him, he'd had the Sobrexa only about 3 weeks before he came to the program, and he was complaining because he couldn't finish a second martini. He just absolutely was making himself drink. So I like those kind of stories.
Hey, good stories.
You're right. You never know what's going to work, and things work differently, but that's why we measure this at the end of a year. Yeah. You know,
and it sounds like good success rates. What I do like about it personally, and this is just me, is that I hear a lot of these stories about people that just totally have to quit alcohol to, you know, avoid that risk of making it a problem. But I see them constantly going through this battle. Like it's 3 years of pain and trying to avoid it and avoiding situations. And to me, that doesn't sound like a life that I'd want to live. It sounds sort of stressful.
Exactly.
And I see them, then they go back to it. You know, they have them, what do they call it? Relapses.
Yep.
And I don't really think addiction is a disease. I think we sort of as a society makes it that way, but I'm probably wrong in that assumption. But certainly I like the idea of Sobrexa. I like the idea of your program that you've got, because it allows people to still enjoy that part of life that we've created as a society. And not everyone has to agree with that, but I think, you know, for a lot of us, we do enjoy that drink with the friends. And if we can just get control on it, then there's going to be a little less problems as well.
And I always avoid the word control, because you have to control that your body's not in balance. My goal for people, when they say, I'm doing pretty good, I'm controlling it, I say, you're not done. So keep taking it.
Keep taking it.
Yeah, right. When your body's in balance, you won't have to control it. You'll have to watch out if you catch yourself going for that, you know, excessive amount, and then you just go back on the Sobrexa. We want people to not have this sort of relapse hanging over their heads the rest of their lives.
Okay. Well, look, I want to wrap it up. I've got one more question just on that. How long do people typically have to take Sobrexa? I mean, I guess it depends on their level of imbalance and all that sort of stuff, but is there an average that people take it for and then don't need to continue it?
8 weeks. That's the average.
8 weeks. And then
in 8 weeks, people that take it for 8 weeks, over 80% of them at the end of a year still have no excessive cravings for alcohol. And that doesn't mean they didn't have a bad night, Lee, and they drank more than they wanted. You know, we've all done that. But it means that it's not a problem in their life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool, love it. Frank, thank you for sharing. I've got a few quick questions for you, Frank.
Sure.
Well, I'll say that they're one-sentence answers as best
all
you
right.
can. And we'll probably nail through them pretty quickly without missing the essence of the answer. Number one is, do you have any routines that you believe contribute to your success?
Yeah, I think that at my stage of life, every day I wake up, first thing I'm serious. I mean, I make a conscious effort to say, my life is not my own.
My life is not my own. Interesting. And what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
Boy, I got a lot of advice for that guy. well, I'd say, young Frank, always believe, always know, you can have any life you choose.
And what is your meaning of success?
Well, philosophically, I don't think success and failure are separate events. But I, to answer your question, I would say success is having developed enough wisdom to become aware of what you need to have a truly meaningful life.
Yeah, I like that. Have you got a piece of productivity advice, something that you believe helps you remain effective in how you go about life?
I do, and I've wrestled with that on different things I don't like to do. But if I find myself unproductive, I simply ask myself, who am I trying to be productive for? If I lose my discipline and I'm not productive, I rob myself, but I also rob others of my passion and my talents.
Good answer. Okay, cool. And someone looking to make some change in their life, whatever it might be, however large a scale it might be, what advice would you give them?
Someone needing to make a change usually has it in their mind for quite a while. They have this plan or dream, but they put it off for a lifetime most of the time. Why? That's the your whole point is why. What's the why? They need to go very deep into that question. They have this desire. Are they just stagnant? I think that most people play with these exciting thoughts rather than to risk failure. But most people just, if they have it, go for it. Just don't. If you have any question, don't go for it. But if you have ready to do it, just go. You'll never know what it's like until you do it.
Mm. Yeah. Good advice. Have you got a favorite food?
Oh, yeah. Probably anything my wife, Carol, and I cook together. We like to cook. And
okay, cool.
Now, right now, it's fresh seafood. Them both come in about 5 blocks from my house in Key Largo, so it's great.
Oh, yeah, I do like it. Do you have a favorite leisure activity?
Yeah, right now, it's getting on that sailboat and sailing out there in these beautiful waters.
Great. Have a favorite book?
I do. I have two, actually, both from Confucius. Great Learning, and the other one is Book of Rights. I think they helped me allow myself to, I don't know, focus on that which I found to be of the greatest importance in my life.
Yeah, cool. And have you got a favorite quote?
Oh, yeah. It's engraved onto a plaque in my sailboat cabin. Throw off the bow lines. Sail away from the safe harbor. Catch the trade winds in your sails. Explore, dream, discover. Mark Twain.
Yeah, good one. Okay, final couple of questions. Do we all have a why? And what does passion and purpose mean to you?
Yeah, the why is interesting. I've thought about this. But everybody has a why, but some only see what that is and ask why. Others, the people I want to hang out with, they see what could be and ask why not.
Yeah. I like that.
Here, you since this is your topic and it's a great, you know, Nietzsche says, he who has a, you may have to look this up, but this paraphrasing, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm just reflecting on that, you know, that asking that question, why do this rather than, you know, why not do that? And I used to, with my mate at school, he used to ask that question in reverse, sort of say, why are you doing that? And he says, well, why aren't you doing that? And it really changes the way you think about things. And when you do that, I think it can really help you, you know, with that progression piece and taking that next step.
I do. And you know, it, and all that ties, that next step ties into kind of where you and I start talking about the, your question, what does passion and purpose mean?
Mm.
I mean, it does mean to me, living a life with passion and purpose is to truly love living a life that's not your own. Can't be an obligation, can't be because you're guilty or anything else. You just love it. It means that on the last day of my life, I'll be joyous that I never compromised.
Yeah.
That, and also what's important is that I'm going to get through life no matter how much I helped anyone.
Yeah.
Making sure that I left them with the knowledge that they did it themselves.
Mm. Yeah, great way to wrap it up, mate, and really pleasing thought. How can the people find out more about you, Frank, and your program?
Best thing is to go to lastcallprogram.com. Get on the site, go to the YouTube channel, the podcasts and things. But on that site, there's a free download for my guide to how modern science has changed addiction. It offers hope and health to the 15 million people in this country or anywhere else in the world who don't seek help. And it's a good thing to pass on, and I ask people to help me do that.
Yeah, nice. Frank, have you had a drinking problem yourself in your life?
I haven't. I've always been I was a martial artist. I competed for a very long time. I've always been in sports, and you know, I got my highs the other another way. But I've always drank reasonably. I grew up in a family they enjoyed, you know, nice wine and nothing excessive. So no, I hasn't. I was actually kind of naive about this problem until, you know, I started working closely with people in my clinics and seeing how much, you know, damage it did to families and to health. That's kind of why I focused in on it.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was getting to. It's just that deeper reason for you for doing it. Because a lot of people, you know, come about these things because they had their own struggles with it and in the process, you know, created that new life and helping others in that way. But you've just
I'd probably be better.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think there's no one right way, but yeah, seeing the pain and suffering from people certainly can, you know, that's, I guess, why I do this show, is that I don't want people to live that life where it's just, it's not real, you know, it doesn't feel right. Because yeah, certainly I was
we
there.
Do the same thing, because it's about unlocking potential. And we said earlier, you know, it's about, hey, you can do this, let go, and, you know, cast off the bow lines. That's how I love that Mark Twain thing.
A good quote. Well, guys, I'll stick all the links in the show notes for Frank to check it out, check out his work. And certainly, if you're interested in that, I'm sure Frank would love to hear from you. So certainly make that connection. Frank, it's been an absolute pleasure having this chat, mate.
All right, Lee, don't forget, when you get to the U.S., you know where the Florida Keys are.
Oh, mate, I've got some connections over there now, so it'll certainly look up. Yeah, thanks, Frank. And guys, check out thehiddenwhy.com, all the links there in the show notes. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Hidden Why podcast, where it's all about living life with passion. For all the latest news and updates, please subscribe online to thehiddenwhy.com.
There you go, guys. Another great show. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got some value from it. I would love to hear from you, and I encourage you to jump onto thehiddenwhy.com. Subscribe to our newsletter. Subscribe to this podcast so you can keep up to date with all that's happening in the Hidden Wired world. And leave me your comments and thoughts on this show or any of the other shows that you're listening to and what you're loving. If you could do me a favor too, it'd be great if you could share it with your network, with your friends, your colleagues, other people that you might think might benefit from this show or any of the other ones you're listening to. Guys, it's all about living life to the fullest and living the life that you desire here at The Hidden Why. I'd love to connect with you. Reach out to me at thehiddenwhy.com. And guys, you know what to do. You need to go out there and breathe more passion into every moment. And you need to do everything with greater purpose. And in doing so, discover your hidden why. This is The Hidden Why. My name is Lee Martinuzzi, signing out.
Thanks for listening to The Hidden Why podcast, where it's all about living life with passion. For all the latest news and updates, please subscribe online, thehiddenwhy.com. This is The Hidden Why.
THY crew, are you looking to discover your hidden why? Then take me up on this opportunity. It's a one-on-one complimentary coaching call valued at $250. Where we chat and define your hidden why and the action steps that you can take to help living towards the life you truly desire. Guys, there's a limited amount of spaces available. What you can do is jump onto thehiddenwhy.com, go to the coaching tab, press the link, and then schedule a time that suits you. Would love to chat with you soon.